Blog Talk Radio.
Editor of the Barnes Review, my co-host, Dave Gaheri, American Free Press's web editor, traveling journalist extraordinaire, and also the host of Who's the Bad Guy, right here on the Overthrow Radio Network at overthrowradio.com. Dave, I see we have a new host, hostess maybe, doing a new show here. I think we should give her a plug. And Dara Beth, and she's doing a show called Harvesting the Truth. And she's getting some pretty good numbers there. What's the times on her show, Dave?
That's Sunday night, 8 o'clock in the evening, Eastern time, till 9.
And she's talking about politics and other important stuff. What's the theme of her show?
That's true. You know, she's talking about a lot of things. But, I mean, I think that Tara Beth was ahead of the curve in a lot of ways because she is calling for, has been calling for, a return to the ideals of the Confederacy. And when she was saying this, you know, a few years ago, I'm sure a lot of people were scratching their heads and going, what are you talking about? You know, the South's going to rise again? Well, turns out that, yeah, we would want the South to rise again if we want to get back America, that's for sure. So the show, as I said, is on it's on Sunday evenings around 8 o'clock till 9, and Harvesting Truth, let me just tell you what the program was about yesterday, Sunday, July 12th. She got into the latest attacks on Confederate history and what supporting the rainbow flag really means. So, yeah, good stuff like that, stuff that we should be talking about. And we're not because of the elite and the mainstream media.
Sounds like a great show. I encourage everybody to tune in. Well, listen, speaking of the Confederate flag now, I'd like to talk just a little bit about that issue. We talked about it last week. We talked about it a few weeks before that, but I think it's a topic that bears constant repeating. When you say we want to return to the ideals of the Confederacy, I'm going to say what I think about that. You tell me what you think about that. Okay. But basically, I will segue into this by saying that I'm here in Stafford County, Virginia, and I live pretty close to the courthouse. And yesterday, as I was coming back from 7-Eleven to get my daily pack of cigarettes and 5 Mountain Dews, I saw, by the way, my teeth do not like that stuff. They keep begging me to stop drinking it. But I saw a big rally right there in front of the courthouse. And it's an old courthouse here in Virginia. Of course, we have lots of Civil War history. Everywhere you set your foot, you might step on a mini ball or a Civil War button buried in the ground somewhere. But here was a sea of red and blue and the St. Andrew's Cross, and a lot of people just smiling and waving their flags right there on Jefferson Davis Highway, which I understand they're petitioning now to change. I guess it'll become Maya Angelou Parkway or maybe Harriet Tubman.
No, Eric Garner or Trayvon Martin or
yes.
Brown, yeah.
Oh, and as another segue, I see that old Freddie Gray, the 24-time loser of heroin sales, has getting the community center, I think it is, named after him. But I guess since it sends exactly just the right message to the youth of America, get yourself out there, deal some heroin, deal some crack, and you might make it big in this country and get a community center named after you. But anyway, I had to stop the car and go talk to these guys and see what they were all about. I mean, were they going to beat me up? Were they Were they going to be haters and evil guys, or what was the story? And of course, it was exactly as I expected. There were families there. There were kids in strollers. There were grandmas and grandpas. There were well-dressed people, all well-spoken, mostly white. But guess what? There were black guys there flying the flag, too, supporting this rally. It was a statement of true diversity, as you always say, and I say it again and again. We are the mainstream. They are not the mainstream. This was true diversity in action. The race is getting along well together, sticking up for a symbol of Southern heritage, which many people are just laughed at, this idea that these liberals and black activists have gotten so fired up about it. This is a symbol of hate. At any rate, it was good to talk to these guys. There were some of them from the League of the South, and there was a Jason Sulzer there, who was the head of organized this rally, really intelligent guy. And it was just a pleasure to speak with them, and the guys were dressed up in Confederate garb, and some of them, you know, and there was just basically a real positive thing happening there, and made me feel a lot better about this, because even we who know what the truth is, and you avoid the mainstream media, but I hear it on the radio, I hear it on TV, this constant barrage can get you down and make you wonder sometimes, have I really got it wrong? And no, the truth is, we don't have it wrong. They got it wrong, and they're going to keep on getting it wrong because they're paid to get it wrong. But anyway, I did get a chance to talk to a guy from the League of the South down there, another real intelligent guy. His last name is Durham. And he handed me a copy of the, I think it's called the Free Magnolia. What is the name of their case? Hold on a second. Let me grab a copy. Yes, the Free Magnolia. And as I looked through it, there's a guy named Michael Hill that's doing a bang-up job on this publication. He's writing all kinds of stuff. It's professionally produced. And
you know who Michael Hill is, right?
He's the head of the – is he one of the top guys at the League of the South?
Well, he basically created it.
Okay. Well, there you go. I know. There's a picture of them here and their staff. They all look like great people. And
they interviewed Michael, and the interview will be up today on the website.
Excellent. Well, then tell us what website and when and where.
Well, it's AmericanFreePress.net. Check it out.
Good stuff. You know, he had some interesting comments. Both of them did, but I'll just tell you what Durham said. Let me get his first name here, Ted. Dennis Durham. Dennis Durham said to me, and he had a very good point. I had a laugh. He says, look at what ISIS is doing in Iraq and Syria, if we can believe what the mainstream tells us. And I think we can to some degree. You have to filter it out. There's grains of truth in there. But I know it's kind of what the Taliban did, right, when they went into took over some portions of Afghanistan. They blew up a few Buddhist statues, right? Well, they were trying to wipe out some of these other cultural remembrances and symbols of pride. I guess that they figure this focuses the population on their movement. But ISIS, of course, recently has been accused of going into Iraq and destroying some of these ancient cultural relics. I don't know if they're sites or if they're just relics or both. And he says this is exactly what the ruling regime is doing in America today. They are trying to wipe out our history, trying to wipe out the symbols that unify a people and their cultural heritage. Here in the South, of course, that flag means a lot more than just slavery, as these guys explained, as our listeners know, and you all know, very well know, 95 to 96% of white people never owned a slave. Slavery was probably an institution that helped impoverish them, their jobs that they could have been doing. And so when you see that flag, they see that flag go up, they just really see a symbol of resistance to federal tyranny. And what do I mean by that? Well, when the war started, these guys in Virginia, there was troops going north and south across this whole state during the whole war. And these guys didn't want a foreign invading force on their state's soil. And this is what most of these guys were doing. It's why they enlisted. That's why they fought. You think a guy from Alabama came all the way up here to Virginia to fight so his rich plantation owners, who he probably never set foot in one of these plantations or sipped the mint julep on the front stoop, you know, he had never even really benefited for the most part, from the institution of slavery. You think that's why he came to Virginia to help the Virginians fight the Union? Absolutely not.
He came up there for the mint julep. I would.
Yeah, well, we don't serve mint juleps here. We mix ours with Mountain Dew. Well, that's today. I'm sorry.
wait a second. First, let me say that Chris Petherick has joined us.
Oh, good morning, Chris. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing well. How are you guys? I'm just sitting back, relaxing, listening to you, Paul. Actually, it's very interesting. I wish I had attended that meeting over the weekend, or that the rally over the weekend. You know, it was
inspiration.
I've seen a lot of that lately. You know, there's a lot of stuff on social media where people are putting up Confederate flags, and you know, the whole thing is heritage, not hate, and you can appreciate that. You know, as people are trying to take back the message on it. Because the message so far, they've been shouted down. It's been, you know, you're a traitor, and you're a traitor to the nation if you like the Confederate flag and you support a legacy of hate, you know, going back to the days of slavery. And for most of the people you speak to, you know, who are interested in that's certainly not where they're coming from. That's not the angle that they're coming from. So there's this incredible disconnect. And Tara Beth, who had her show on last night on the Overthrow Radio Network, Harvesting Truth is the name of her show. It airs 8 to 9 on Sunday nights. She was talking about Freedom Palooza. Yeah, the dog even liked her. Yeah, when they hosted their Freedom Palooza festival over the 4th of July weekend, they had a guy there who is a flag dealer, sells flags. And he was talking about now it's becoming difficult because he says, according to him, the demand is way up for these Confederate flags, but he's having a great deal of difficulty finding anybody who can that he can purchase them from, you know, wholesale, to sell them to people. So you're right, Paul. It is slowly being throttled back. It's being strangled.
Well, you know, listen, we got a chance to talk to those Virginia Flagger guys in that interview for the Barnes Review magazine. And, you know, they're flying their flag on private property. And we kind of discussed this a few weeks ago that it may be that we're not going to make much progress on getting this flag put back up over capitals in the South. If the different states want to resist, I imagine the federal government will punish them in some fashion by holding back highway funds or whatever. You know how that goes. But we can get people to fly this flag over their private property. The question is, let's say you have a black neighbor, and this black neighbor comes to you and says, I'm really offended by that flag. How do you handle that? You talk to them, of course, but, I mean, how would you take it down because it's a constant insult to him, or would you try to educate him? What would you do? Anybody can answer that one.
Well,
that's a hard question.
We got a caller, too.
There's so many emotions tied into this. Oh, please screen them first, though, Dave. Let's not have a repeat of what happened a couple weeks ago.
I said it was Harold.
Oh, Harold. Oh, okay, good. You know, it's such an emotional issue, Paul. It's very difficult to have an intelligent conversation with people about this because they immediately falls back into emotions and about how could you support something and you're supporting hate and it's terrible and look, people are murdering other people over this, you know, over this flag. So just take the flag down and just take it out of existence since it has all of this without really having a discussion about what it is, you know, what it stands for and what it represents. So that's a very good question. I don't know how you confront people. There's a lot of people you can't confront about it.
Does the black nationalists have their own flag that is some symbol of pride to them? I don't know if black people have a flag. They like some of the African flags. They do like the colors red, black, and green, I believe, for symbolic purposes. I mean, maybe you tell the guy to go and buy him some flag he likes and tell him to fly his flag and you're not offended by it. I don't know. At some point in time, we do have to live with our neighbors and have love our neighbors. It's important to the Bible. And
but
so,
you know, Native Americans, I mean, there are certain, obviously we know certain tribes, there was a long history of violence and terrible violence, you know, there. But that has all sort of been pushed aside and ignored. I mean, certainly throughout African history, it wasn't this great utopia that they'd like people to believe. It was extremely violent. slavery existed even before the the white man showed up and started purchasing slaves and then bringing them to Europe and then the New World as well. And so all throughout the world, we're seeing this. You know, in New Zealand, where my family comes from, the Maoris, for instance, there was for many of them, there was a they were cannibals because there was limited protein on that island after they went through a lot of the bird population, and it wasn't as ready. And there were tribes and various clans that would go down and raid other clans, and they would take away women and rape them and turn them into their wives, and it was extremely violent. The British came along and actually, when they colonized it, they kind of the British are very officious, so they set up courts and they stabilized everything and stabilized that country. And I have an aunt who's Maori, and she remembers she was very happy when the British showed up because they protected their particular village they had from other more aggressive villages. But that in the general narrative in that country, that's been lost, because now all they talk about is how the white men came and they stole all the land from the Maoris, and so now they're giving land and setting aside certain areas for the Maori, and it's become very similar to what's going on here in the States.
Well, my point, I guess, is there comes a point when you do have to kind of disregard other people's feelings, because hurt feelings have been used for so long to create guilt. And I do think people need symbols of their own cultural pride. And if you haven't got one, don't take mine. And so it's a sad thing when people don't have some unifying symbol of their own culture to fly with pride or to display with pride. Dave, why don't you bring Harold on there and see what he's got to say?
All right, let's bring Harold on.
Harold, yeah, good
you
morning.
Out there?
I'm out here. Good morning to all of you. Hey, listen,
I just wanted to say this,
that people need to grow up a little bit. You know, these people who want diversity are going to have to accept diversity. And if they don't like it, well, I guess that says more about their level of hypocrisy than anything I can think of.
Well, that is so true. That is so true, because now we can fly the rainbow flag in our yard, and we could probably fly the flag of Robert Mugabe over there in Zimbabwe, right? This mass murderer.
Yeah.
But we can't fly a Confederate flag. And it's hypocrisy, and it seems a little bit of jealousy, too, because we have these symbols. I wonder what really is running through the mind of the black guy who is offended by the flag. Because, listen, it was amazing when I was listening to this the celebration, the taking down of the Confederate battle flag over the South Carolina State House. And so we saw a very solemn ceremony in which two white cops in almost a military-like ceremony very slowly and very solemnly took that flag down, folded it up, rolled it, tied it, they handed it to a black cop. And so he treated it with respect, because it is state property, for crying out loud. But one of the black commentators I was listening to said, oh, this is ridiculous. All this respect for this flag. I just don't get it. This is just a flag of hate and all this. But he says, that guy should have dropped the flag on the ground. And I'm thinking, wow, there's a level of activism in this country where they're really juicing up the black population to really believe that this flag isn't something that it really is. And you mentioned that, Chris. You said there's a real disconnect here. And that's what you saw when you saw this black cop take that, I think he was a state cop, I'm not sure, it was an honor guard or some type, take that flag very respectfully, and here his co-racialist is telling him basically that he'd done it, he just let it fall on the ground and probably stomped on it. And, you know, they asked, excuse me, I want to say something else about Harold's point. Here we have this guy who shoots 9 blacks in a church. Okay, fine. And then we have...
Allegedly.
And then we have a black guy who tortures to death. We've mentioned this before, this Greek family, right, for hours and hours. Now, we're supposed to show forgiveness and tolerance for this black fellow, poor black guy, grew up with racism, grew up with hatred around him, the hatred that of blacks by whites that unifies the black race, constant racism, please forgive him. He came from poverty, which I don't even know if it's true. Yet one white kid, one white man, he's 21, but he looked pretty immature here, kills these people, and yet the entire, every single person who flies that flag is branded under the same, the same large brand, we'll say. It's just shocking to think.
That's what you call logic, my friend.
Yeah, logic of the new world order.
That's what they call logic.
But, yeah, that's right. That's right. But it really does need to be countered. And so we're not going to see it coming from the states. I don't think too many, a few state reps have been standing up in their local communities, but others are not. And they're bending over. Nikki Haley, these vote grubbing white politicians, specifically Nikki Haley, Lindsey Graham and these other ones have flip flopped and changed their mind on the issue. And they're just pandering to the moment. You know, we're going to see if this issue even comes up. But I will guarantee you, amongst Republicans specifically who are looking for minority votes, I would think, unless you guys know that one of them has come out with a different stance, that every one of them is going to jump on this bandwagon. Because not one of them is going to stand up and say that this is a symbol of cultural pride.
Except for Trump.
Did he? Because I'm not sure.
I doubt it. I don't think Trump would stick his neck out on something like that. I just don't. On that particular issue, he's appealing to his constituents. Honestly, I think that the flag is largely an issue for a small number of people in the South. You know, and I don't think it's that big of a deal across the nation. I think Republicans are more worried largely in the standard stuff, the economy, illegal immigration, this type of thing. And I don't think that's really going to, you know, that's going to be a big issue. They might ask them what they think, but I don't think any of them is going to make a stand on it. Politicians just don't do that, you know. And Trump is clearly appealing to a very angry constituent portion of the of the Republican Party.
Yeah, people in the North ought to be asking this question though: what's coming next? All right, they better understand that. I mean, this is an easy target for the South. As I talk about my Mountain Dew, look at the little logo they have for this company. It was originally a mountain guy in bare feet and a straw hat that was all beat up. I mean, the mischaracterization of the people of the South has been going on since the beginning of the Civil War. Well, really before that. But, I mean, they've been...
But, you know, Paul, people don't even know what July 4 is. I saw this great video. I was just going through, you know, I was up and drinking my coffee and watching this. It was last week it was airing. It was one of these, like, you know, television talk show hosts at night who was, you know, making a joke. I forget who it was, but he was out there interviewing people on the street. I think it was New York City, asking them, you know, what is July 4? What does it mean? What is it really about? And nobody could answer what it was. Nobody had a clue what July 4 was about, what the point of it was. So to go in there and expect people to have an understanding of the nuanced, complicated history of the Civil War and what it was about, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's just not going to happen today for the overwhelming majority of Americans.
You wanted to say something, Harold?
Yeah, I was just going to say, my God, people are really that stupid that they don't have any idea of what the 4th of July is. Do we even have a country?
Well, listen, it's all part of the plan, I guess, is to slow everybody down and dumb them down so bad that they don't ask too many questions. But
exactly. Anybody
who doesn't know what happened on July 4th needs to find out pretty quickly. But I will just say this, that really the characterization of people in the South is racist to some degree, and it's an insult the way that it's been portrayed as backwoods hillbillies when many of these people are extremely intelligent. Dave, you made the point. You're going down to League of the South to the place where To Kill a Mockingbird was written, right? And you mentioned to me how many of the great American authors were Southerners.
That's right. I'm going up. Remember, I'm in the Deep South. Yeah.
I keep forgetting that. You're on that panhandle. You still got 500 miles to go before you hit Key West, although I think that's kind of like not really the South.
No.
Miami, really. You know, kind of stops halfway through there and Okefenokee.
Well, there's a lot of people who want to split Florida into a north and south, you know, actually two separate states. It's that different.
Yes, it is. Well, listen, you are going down to the League of the South. You're going where? When are you going? What are you going to be doing? Who are you going to be seeing? And what's the goal of this whole thing? What do they got going on?
Right. Well, tomorrow I'm going up to Monroeville, Alabama, which is where To Kill a Mockingbird was set at. You know, a lot of it is based on true events with this fellow Atticus Finch, who a new book's coming out, a sequel, shall we say. It's really not a sequel. It was actually a precursor to Killing Mockingbird, but she changed it around a bit. And, of course, Atticus Finch is known throughout the country to those who read, and there was a movie made about it, of course, with Gregory Peck, as a fellow who, defended integration. And this book shows that Atticus Finch was not an integrationist. He was a staunch segregationist. So going up there for the launch of that book at the bookstore in Monroeville, Alabama, and then on 24th of this month is the National Convention of the League of the South, which has been around for 21 years. And it's exactly what we're talking about. These are folks who are traditionalists. They want to bring back America the way it was. It was founded by white Northern Europeans, and certain ideals and certain mores and cultures were with these folks and were with us for all these years until, of course, these, what many people call and Michael Hill called, the cultural communists took over. So I want to see what these folks have to say and report back to you all.
Well, I'll tell you guys one thing. I've never flown the Confederate flag, but I'm going to just for the heck of it.
Well, good for you. It's a beautiful thing, I'll tell you. It's a bolder flag, the United States flag. We look at the United States flag from a distance, so stars kind of fade into the blue field, make a light blue, and then maybe they like it for this. The red and white stripes kind of fade into a pink. Hey, man, I like the American flag. But the Confederate flag is a bold flag, and it's they had them out there, too, of course, as we discussed on previous shows. There's multiple versions of that gorgeous flag. But it was just good to see those people out there, and so many of them well-behaved. Of course, as we rednecks like to do down here when we go by and we want to show support, we don't honk our horns. We put our cars in neutral and then rev them up really high and burn out the motor. So there was a lot of that going on. But I suggest people take a look at some of the photos we got of these people that were there. We're going to be posting them later this week, I imagine, on the American Free Press website. Well, is there any other comments that anybody would like to make on the flag? Because when we're finished with this, then I am going to kind of jump into a discussion for the time we have left of a completely different subject.
You know, Paul,
just one comment.
Sure, go ahead, Harold. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's fine. It's no problem. I just wanted to say this. I think there's going to be a backlash on this. I think what's going to happen is that a lot of people are going to say, oh, we can't fly that. Well, I'm going to fly it just because I can. And I think sometimes these people that try too hard to destroy things will find in the long run that there is a backlash.
I agree with you.
I say that before, Chris, I want to cut you off because
sure,
I want to give you the last word on this because
yeah,
I think you're going to agree with me. I don't agree with Harold. I don't think there is going to be a backlash, at least anything significant. There was a story yesterday, Confederate flag supporters rise up to defend embattled symbol, and supposedly, here we had 4,500 people turned out for this Florida Southern Pride Ride in Ocala, 1,500 vehicles. But I just don't see enough people across the country really giving a hoot and a holler, much like you said, Chris, about how these politicians really don't give a darn. I mean, it's like flyover country in the middle of the United States, right? It's something that only a few people care about. So I would have to disagree with Harold. Chris?
Yeah, I think it's gonna those few states down there in the South where it matters, it's gonna continue to matter, and those people are gonna fly their flag no matter what, no matter what anybody says, and they just don't give a damn about it. But I gotta agree with you, Dave. I think overall, across the country, it's people are gonna unfortunately move on and fail to recognize the fact of the importance of this issue. And to me, the importance of this issue is not necessarily whether you even like the flag or support the flag, but it's about an individual and an area's right to define their heritage, to define their legacy, and to establish themselves and be who they want to be without this pressure from New York City or Los Angeles or these other areas where they have these large media which just hammer these people. And so that's why I support the flag. I don't really, you know, my family didn't fight for the Confederacy. We weren't even in the country at that point. So, you know, my mother's side came over from Italy around, you know, like 1910, and my father didn't arrive from New Zealand until the 1960s. So it doesn't mean as much to me, but we have family down in the South, and it means a tremendous amount to them and their heritage. And they still are people, you know, they remember their grandmother telling stories about what it was like, you know, and what it was like for the Confederacy. So I respect that, and I think the rest of the country should really respect it because, yeah, like Paul said, today it's the flag. What's next? You know, what's going to be? What are they going to go after next?
Well, I agree with you, Chris. Well, you're absolutely right about that. We have one guy locally in one of the local towns up here in northern Idaho who actually has a replica a vehicle with General Lee, and he drives it around every once in a while, and everybody likes it.
That's pretty funny. Yeah, I was with a lot of kids talking. I heard an interview with a black guy the other day who said he loved the General Lee. He always wanted General Lee as a kid. He made models of the General Lee. Every time his father would find him, he'd say, "You can't bring that Confederate flag in his house, boy." You know? And the poor guy, Cooter, I guess that's his name, right? Cooter. I never saw the show, I have to admit. But he's been pushing forward, and he's selling his own memorabilia and everything else, doing what he can and trying to become a little spokesman of this.
He was a congressman, I believe. Yeah. Cooter. Drove the tow truck.
Yes, that's correct.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Yeah, he drove the tow truck, I remember.
Yeah, no, there was probably, tell me there wasn't a characterization of a particular Southern cop. Don't Southern cops also have
that was Roscoe P. That was Roscoe P. Coltrane. He was the, he was the bumbling, oafish cop. Well, actually, he was, and he was always frustrated, but I forget the guy who was underneath him. He was the deputy. He was the one who was kind of the bumbling, oafish cop.
I guess my point there is that here we have a characterization of white cops today as being brutal and racist, right? And it's kind of a continuation of this caricature of Southern cops, too. I mean, listen, I'm telling you that when you lie long enough about people, it sticks. And so it wouldn't surprise me if black kids growing up, if they see the old editions, the reruns, the Dukes of Hazzard, probably think it's a History Channel program, okay? So,
they might think it's actually happening live. I mean, that's how stupid they are. They don't know what July 4th is. They don't know who the president is. You can imagine it would be anything.
Well, pretty much. Well, listen, so I'm going to get the last word on this. I'm sorry. It's my show. Ha ha. But I think Yeah, that's good too. Or you disconnect.
Right.
But I think Harold is partially right, and I think you guys are partially right. I think it depends on. There will be. There's already been a little pushback. We haven't seen Confederate flag rallies here, and it's getting parents to discuss stuff with their kids. This is what I always say: that education is the cure for just about everything. Real history is the cure. Knowledge and truth are the cure. And so it is opening up the chance for people to talk about something that we never thought we were going to have to talk about. The history of the flag, the pride of the Confederacy, the resistance to federal tyranny, the history of the United States. I mean, we were talking about the Morrill Tariff back in our last program briefly. But in 1832, they slapped the South around pretty good. And I believe the way it worked was this. The Northern industrialists were manufacturing goods at a very expensive rate. So a Southerner, really, the vast majority of these Southerners, when as well off as the city dwellers, I believe, were buying these products that were brought in from England and France. The North decided they were going to tariff these goods. And we always, at the American Free Press, and a lot of nationalist groups love tariffs because it punishes the importer and helps you buy American. And they were going to force these Southerners to buy American, even if they couldn't afford to buy American. And in the end, what happened was the states, Southern states, decided to wanted to nullify this tariff. And what they did was they said that they were going to, when the ships came in from foreign ports, they were going to stick the tariffs on them, and most of these were federal tax people, right, and a federal tax would so slap the tariff on. Well, they were just going to ignore this federal law. And this brought up this whole idea of, can a state ignore a federal law that they think is bad for their state. And this is happening today with this legal immigration stuff. States tried this nullification angle. And by the way, what the Southerners do, they just let the ships come in, didn't apply the tax, or they applied the tax at a much lower rate and let their Southern people buy these tariffed goods. But here we have Arizona, who has determined that some of these federal immigration laws either aren't strict enough or they can do a better job themselves, and they've tried their own form of nullification, and we've seen now what a strong, overly invasive federal government will do. It just passes a law that says, we don't care about your state. We don't care that you're the ones on the ground who really know about what's going on here. We're just going to make our law, and you're going to stick to it. The question is whether or not this is ever going to resolve itself. And in the end, what happened with the nullification crisis was Andrew Jackson, a funny guy, a great president, but he did not believe that the states had a right to secede, and he was going to crush them. And Buchanan, of course, was truly a Southerner, I believe, and a Southern sympathizer. And so, and maybe it was James Calhoun and Clay were very prominent at the time. As a matter of fact, I think it was John Quincy Adams, right, the second son, John Adams, John Quincy Adams was president. And Calhoun was his vice president, ended up resigning and wanting to be Jackson's vice president. And it was very convoluted. But in the end, it got kicked down the road to the 1860s. And the same incident, the same set of circumstances was what actually led to the Civil War. It was this the tariffs that were laid on these goods coming from foreign countries, forcing the South to buy goods they could not afford. In the end, the Southern states decided not to obey the federal government, and they decided to remove these federal taxing, I don't know what to call them, offices, we'll say. And so what the Union did was they stopped the federal taxing offices and forced the ships to come into places like Fort Sumter. And so they came into Fort Moultrie and Fort Sumter, and that's when they said, the South said, enough's enough. We're not going to let you send your foodstuffs and armaments to Fort Sumter, and to basically continue feeding and hiding your tariff masters. And that's when the whole thing started. And trust me, if Buchanan had done a better job, I think what they ended up deciding to do in 1832 was increase the tariff very small amounts up to the 1860s. But if they had Jackson had his way, he would have probably invaded with a force into South Carolina, forced South Carolina to be subjugated at that time, which would have been probably a mini Civil War. So I'm not so sure some of the other Southern states were ready for it. But in the end, all that happened was that same issue and the core of the Civil War was, can the federal government dictate to your state what is the best thing for your state when your own people unanimously disagree with it? At any rate, I think there's going to be a little bit of a backlash. We'll see how long it goes on. But I think if the backlash is education and a cultural discussion, and if it's even discussing it with your neighbors of any race, creed, or religion, then that's fine. These guys at this rally yesterday were 100% convinced that this was a wedge into an attack upon the last devout area of the country. They believe the South is the last truly unanimously Christian area, and that this was an attempt to get their Bibles, their guns, and now their culture. So we'll see what happens. I think we should stay on this.
Thanks for having the show, Paul. Appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you, Harold. Now let's jump to the different. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Okay.
He said see you later. That's all.
Oh, very good. All right. Well, listen, we're going to talk about a completely different subject for the next 20 minutes of the show. I got to tell you, Chris, I'm way behind on this paper, so we're just going to stick it out here for an hour today. But one of the subjects that's of great interest to me is ancient mysteries of the Americas. And, of course, several programs on History Channel have popped up recently, and there's been a great increase in this subject. Some of the claims about ancient visitors to the Americas are kind of outlandish, but a lot of them are true. And one of the places where we've looked into inexplicable mysteries of the ancient past is in the American Northeast. They're all over the country, but that's going to be kind of the focus of the remaining portion of our program today. And one of these is these mysterious megaliths of New England. Now, up in New England, in multiple states, including Connecticut, Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, there's weird finds that people have come across over the past few decades, of which mainstream historians like to scoff and lie about and hide, I guess, because of their own concern for making fools of themselves if they don't stick with the mainstream line of history. But what they found up there were not only some really pretty sophisticated, like, underground chambers and standing stones, reminiscent of kind of like Stonehenge, nothing of that size or really sophistication, but some very interesting constructs. They've also found a lot of the European, ancient European carvings, and particularly Ogam, which was the ancient Irish, I guess they call it stick writing, you might know, Chris, where you would draw a vertical line or horizontal line and make marks above below the line. And these were kind of almost like runic futhark, right, I think it was called. But in the heart of New England here are these sites of what we think are great antiquity. And these sites are so sophisticated. They're so mysterious that lots of serious archaeologists have, like, declined to even study them because of the monumental implications. What it basically means is that if these are what we think they are, it means that Europeans were over here not just 1,000 years ago. About 1,000 years ago, Vikings were here. But we're talking thousands of years before that. Last show, we talked about these mysterious marine men of Michigan who were mining copper up in the Upper Peninsula up there and perhaps even transporting it down to Poverty Point now in Louisiana to send it back. Now, these aren't those people. These are pretty much, I think, probably either Celt-Iberians, the Celts, the Iberians. And what happened at the time, I think, was most of the, and by the way, also Carthaginians who came from North Africa, but were also up in Iberia in the Spanish Peninsula. But they kind of banded together against the Romans, and the Celts had amazing ships. The Phoenicians, which were the forerunners of the Carthaginians, also had, as we all know, amazing seafaring capacity. But these places, I think you'd be surprised how many they are. Here's a couple of the names of them. That's Mystery Hill in New Hampshire. There's the Upton Cave. There's a Calendar 1 and Calendar 2 site. There's a Gungi Wamp site in Druid Hill are in Connecticut. It's funny that one place is called Druid Hill. It had Druid Hill and Bridget's Hill. Bridget was an ancient Celtic goddess, I believe, for hundreds of years. Even when the first settlers came, they were naming these sites after places in Europe or even adapting Indian names to them because they resembled, there was something strange going on. The Europeans would name them after sites they'd seen in England because they were pretty much, or England and Ireland, pretty much convinced that these were built by people that had come before them, perhaps Irish monks or Celtic monks, although I'm not so sure. But anyway, and I'm looking at a booklet that I came up with. So I'm going to read a couple passages here and there from it. But there was a clergyman named Cotton Mather at the time, and he found a lot of these Ogamic inscriptions up in New England, which people said were just plow marks from stones, and it's almost impossible because people have translated them since then. But this was way back in 1712, and he discovered some strange cuts on an exposed rock in Dighton, Massachusetts. It was a rock that was out in the water, and it was far from where a plow could have cut it. So it was obviously not a plow, something that man had done with a plow, or modern man. And it was in the Taunton River, and he began marking the stuff down, and he made inscriptions of them. So he sent this stuff off to the Royal Society in London, England, and he told them that he had found this just amazing thing and that these carvings were an ancient scriptural alphabet. And so his letter generated little or no interest, actually. The people, the scientists at the Royal Society at the time, they were looking at rock inscriptions just now in Ireland, so they weren't buying that the Irish could have gotten over here. But later on, these European inscriptions were found to be a form of Gaelic Celtic. And so we think the Celts were over here in American Northeast well before Columbus, perhaps even as early as, say, 1500 to 1900 or 1500 B.C. But the one site that everybody kind of looks at and almost has to admit that. So the ancient Europeans were over here. There's this site in New Hampshire called Mystery Hill, and there's standing stones there. There's underground chambers. There are there's drainage there. For instance, I'll tell you a little bit about it. If you stand at one of the stones in Mystery Hill, and it's like what we would call the standing stone. If you looked over top of some of these megaliths, which are large standing stones, on the solstices, you know, and the equinoxes, and I'll just talk about that in a second about exactly how they did that. But you'll see these the sun setting and rising over some of them on the solstice days, and setting and rising over top of these stones in the equinox days. For those who don't get it, if you take the year and you make a circle out of it instead of a straight timeline, you would divide the year into four quadrants. Let's call the northern it's a cross through the middle of a circle. So the point of the northern cross would be, say, the June solstice. This is where the day, you have the longest day of the year, and after that point, the days get shorter. Our right arm of the cross would be the fall equinox, equi, meaning equal. This is where the days are 12 hours long, 12 hours a day, and 12 hours at night. So that's the equinox. That was important to them. This marked when the sun was also going to start, the days were going to start getting longer again. The southern arm of the cross would have been the winter solstice. This is when the shortest day of the year happened, a very scary time for Europeans who, unless you were a priest or something and understood this is a cyclical thing. And because the days were getting shorter and shorter and shorter from the time of the spring equinox from the fall equinox to the time of the winter solstice. And some of these people, the uneducated ones, the primitives, would think, well, with the sun, are the days just going to keep getting shorter and shorter and shorter until there's no more sun at all? So the priests would love to come out and have a ceremony where they would mark the sun as the knowing that this was the shortest day of the year, and then ensuring people, of course, that the days would begin to get longer after this, to the point when you come to the spring equinox, when the days were equal again, and then the days get longer and longer and longer. So it's a scary time for people. It's why they created many of these megalithic complexes and why they lined them up. They wanted to know their calendars. They wanted to know when the days were going to get longer, when they were going to get shorter. They even knew that these people were sophisticated enough, according to researchers at Mystery Hill, to have sighting stones that would tell them the metonic cycle. And that's the cycle of the moon. It takes just not a certain amount of time to go full and then to a crescent moon and full again. But it also takes a certain number of years, if I can't remember off the top of my head, maybe 59 years or 58 years, for it to return to the exact same spot in the sky. So these people who are building these sites were very intelligent. They had been watching the skies for hundreds of years, but they were also incredible builders. And Chris, are you there?
No. Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here.
Dave. Okay. Well, listen, you're a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that critics or skeptics of these sites in New England found, they thought they were underground root cellars from their ancestors. A little bit, you know, like when the solstice would come up, the sun might come over the hill and it would shine through a small hole in this underground chamber, and it would shine in the back of the wall on a quartz crystal that had been placed into the wall. And so people said, well, they're just root cellars. Now, these root cellars had 1.5-2-ton lintels on top, maybe 6 of them lined up.
Mm.
You're a farmer. If you were going to make a root cellar, how would you do it?
You dig a hole, yeah, pretty much, you know, and get some drain, make sure you got decent drainage, and that's about it, yeah.
Right, and you cover it over with wood, maybe you rebuild it, but you certainly don't drag 1.5-ton stones, 5 or 6 of them over top. Now, this is what they found up in Mystery Hill, but they also found one of the most...
I mean, you would be careful, and you would watch the placement to make sure the sun shined in the right position, this type of thing, you know, along those lines. But the idea that, that you would, you know, drag a 2-ton stone over the top of it or go to the lengths of... I've read about some of these things. Go to the lengths that they went to construct these things, you know. No, you wouldn't. Absolutely wouldn't do that.
And you probably wouldn't line up for your root cellars so that on each of the 4 major divisions of the year, the sun came through and hit a quartz crystal in the back. You got better things to do. We're talking about Indians who are out there wanting to fight you. You're talking about feeding your starving family. You might even be talking about making sure that your turkey doesn't eat up all your green beans. So people don't have anybody who doesn't know, that's what Chris was doing before the show, making sure his turkeys didn't eat up his green beans.
Anyway, had a turkey in my green beans. I was chasing them out, yeah.
But interestingly, so they were skeptics, and they just wouldn't listen. Now these are root cellars. And, of course, these markings, these carvings that have, like, the Eye of Bel and Ogamic inscriptions, which some researchers have translated, they're like, well, those are just the marks of the roots on these stones. And so they kept stopping. As a matter of fact, the Mystery Hill site was bought by a guy named Jonathan Patti back before the Civil War. And they used it as a way station on the Underground Railroad because they would hide slaves up north, and I guess maybe even northern slaves who wanted to escape, but they would hide them underground in these very dry and very safe and very secretive underground cellars. But one of the amazing underground constructs at Mystery Hill has like a 2.5-ton, 3-ton glacial erratic there. It's one that was just dropped by a glacier. And then next to that, you'll find this wall that's built with ovary construction that resembles the stone walls in Ireland so closely. And another wall might be made of two or three, four, five-ton stones. The bottom is paved. The thing drains. And one of the amazing things is they have a sacrificial process, what they call a sacrificial altar. I'm not exactly sure what that is. It has a runnel around the side to drain something. But right underneath this table, this large table, which is above ground, in this chamber that is underground, there's like a very carefully made and layered, I guess, what is it? There's a tube, we'll say, made through the stone that comes up under the sacrificial table. And inside the chamber, there's like a step there, as if a man could step on the top of a step, speak into the opening, and this opening would go up, and a voice would come out underneath the sacrificial altar. We don't know whether it was animals that were sacrificed there, which is what the Celts would have done. Well, the Celts and the Phoenicians both did practice some forms of human sacrifice, but the Phoenicians particularly were sacrificers. They sacrificed children a lot of times, and there's a graveyard and an ancient Carthaginian graveyard in North Africa, I believe, that's got like thousands of children. So they were kind of a primitive, I would say, almost to the point of sacrificing humans. But there's only one other place in the world where this exact construction is. And there's no way, by the way, that American colonialists did this, that American Indians did this. I mean, why would you go to the trouble of all this work and make this tube to come up underneath the sacrificial altar? There's only one other place in the world where this happens, and that's on the islands of Malta. And Malta, too, of course, is extremely famous for its massive megalithic structures, very much related to this. So they're not sure. Maybe the Maltese people, whoever was in Malta, had been able to sail here or come with. Who knows? They may have come together. As I mentioned, the Phoenicians and the Celts were hanging out together. The Tartesians were there. This was a group on the west part of the Iberian Peninsula. Even Semites came. Some Jews allegedly came. I don't know if they were Jews at the time or they were called, what were they, Hebrews or whatever. I mean, you had to have bookkeepers. And so they may have all come together at the time. So you're finding all this stuff and everybody's denying that it's ancient. But if you look at this, if you go online and look at pictures of the Oracle Chamber, I believe they call this one in Mystery Hill, there's absolutely no doubt. You'll be convinced. But there's also beehive tombs up there. There's like long tunnels that go into underground chambers in several of the states. They look a lot like New Grange. You remember New Grange? That's that massive burial mound. I think it's in England. I better be right about that one if I'm going to be talking about it. But when the solstice sun sets or rises, it comes through this long chamber and hits again either quartz or garnet in the back. And it was a real show, I would imagine, when the events would happen. And of course, it could very well have been the people who built Stonehenge got over here. We're not 100% sure. We just know that it ain't the American colonists who built this stuff, because there's just too many of them. There's literally hundreds of, well, probably not thousands, but at least hundreds of these underground chambers all over New England. I'm going to say what Charles Pearson said. Charles Pearson, luckily, bought the Mystery Hill site and he realized that there was something going on there. He bought it from Patti, or Patti fell into bankruptcy or something. I can't remember what the story was. But Patti had bought it, or at least Patti understood, Jonathan Patti understood, that what he was sitting on was something of profound importance. And so a guy named Charles Pearson came along and bought the place, or surveyed it, excuse me, in 1987. I think he ended up buying it. And he says, after listening to what everybody had to say about it, he says, the number of very large and prominent stones is limited. And those very large stones happen to be the ones that make up the significant astronomical alignments. The state that this site is a calendar, by statistical probability or by accident, and not by design, demonstrates a complete misinterpretation of the obvious physical evidence at the site and a misrepresentation of the facts located at the site. Comments were made indicating that with over 100 standing stones at this site and the freedom to adjust the observation center of the site to any location desired, that purely by chance one could demonstrate a calendar site at any location. This is obviously not the case at Mystery Hill. In other words, people were saying, look, these are just standing stones. They just happen to be standing up. And if I stand over here, the sun's going to set over here. But if you stand at a central location, they have a stone there that I think was the stone you'd stand at for these ceremonies, I guess it was, because you're not finding graves there. You're not finding a lot of artifacts there. But you are finding, if you stand on this one site and you stand there at the solstices and equinoxes and other times of the year at that one spot, remember, there's probably an alignment for every day of the year, you're going to find that the sun is hitting right over top or a little bit to left or right, because it has been thousands of years and some of the stones have fallen over, they've moved a little bit. But you're going to find that this absolutely has to be something more sophisticated than pure chance. At any rate, I think that there's another site, and I'm not as familiar with this, but it's called Gungywamp, G-U-N-G-Y-W-A-M-P. I believe this is in Connecticut. And so one of the guys, I interviewed a guy who'd been there, he's a researcher at this place, back when I wrote a booklet about this. He says, when he was at Gungywamp, by the way, there's a society called the Gungywamp Society, I need to check them out. He saw a site that he would never forget. The guy's name is David Barron, by the way. He said, the setting sun had cast a beam of light through the vent shaft at the back of the chamber in which we were standing. This beam of light slowly moved down the east wall and spotlighted into the small beehive crypt near the entrance. This stone-lined tube was designed precisely to permit the equinoctial sun to fully penetrate the chamber's dark interior on only 2 days of the year, March 22 and September 21. Those are the equinoxes, of course. The high density of garnet in the stones at the back magnified the intensity of the sunlight entering the chamber. It certainly acts as a predictable calendar, even now. Carbon dated, I don't know what they're carbon dating, and we're going to have to say that we have had some complaints in the Barnes Review about the carbon dating technique, which we talked about last week, but it gives you a good idea. But they carbon dated this thing to 8600. So this is 400 to 500 years before the Vikings, and this is not the kind of thing the Vikings made. The Vikings would make, Chris and Dave, like you guys would probably make your impromptu shelters in a cold climate. You would dig a deep hole, you would place sod or timbers over the top. And so this is just not a kind of a Viking construct. At any rate, there's mounds up there. I heard a lot of stuff from a lot of people after we published these articles that they had seen odd things in their own hometowns, and we started getting pictures of stuff coming in. And one guy, I don't remember the name of the guy, it was a beehive team. I wonder if I've got a picture of it in this thing. But the thing practically just spoke for itself. And let me see if I can find that thing. By the way, you ought to go online and check out Mystery Hill as well. And they have a drawing of this amazing construction. It's a massive site. I think it's 20 acres of stuff. But one of these wasn't pretty. I wish I could remember the name of it, but it would have convinced you right then and there. Now, there's one called the Upton Chamber. That's the name of it. It's in Upton, Massachusetts. This is a long underground tunnel, 6 feet tall, rocks all around. Had to have taken years to construct. And at the end of the, let me see what it says here. The building techniques used in this chamber are extremely sophisticated, most definitely neither American Indian nor of Viking design, but closely resemble stone constructions of religious sites in England and Ireland, the British Isles. So at any rate, listen, we're almost out of town. I wish I could have talked more about this and made it a little more interesting. It was a little drab compared to exactly what the true history of these amazing megalithic mysteries are. If anybody is interested in getting a copy of this particular paper that I wrote on it, which is 48 pages long with pictures and captions and interesting observations from multiple alternative scientists, go ahead and put a comment down in there. How about that in the comment area under this program, and just say you'd like to receive a physical copy of this booklet, The Mysterious Megaliths of New England. Leave your address, or maybe not. Maybe leave your...
Give them your email address.
Yeah, maybe you're right. People don't want to put their own email address in the comment box. Mine is angel@his.com. That's angel@his.com. Put radio.
You can also go to the Facebook page, facebook.com/overthrowradio, and right there, actually, I posted the brief, you know, intro for today's radio show. So you can like us on Facebook, and then post a comment there too as well, and even email us directly through Facebook's Messenger, which is lousy, but Paul will get that as well too.
Very good. If you do email me, then read your physical address. Maybe an email where I can, obviously, I just respond to you. And I'll send you a copy of this booklet for just the cost of the shipping and handling. It's a $7 booklet, but I'll send it to you for $3 or $3.50, whatever it costs you to mail. I think you'll find it interesting. At any rate, listen, I am behind on this week's issue of American Free Press. I worked all weekend on the Barnes Review, editing our next issue, getting that together. We've got some great stuff for both of these publications. American Free Press is AmericanFreePress.net. Barnes Review is BarnesReview.com. We're in the midst of revamping our Barnes Review website. I think everybody's really going to like what's going on there. It's not quite up yet, but it will be in the next week or so, I do believe. We encourage you to fly whatever flag you want to fly. Remember your cultural history. And I'm going to thank both you guys for being on the show today. Didn't get the chance to say much in that second half an hour, but that's okay, because that's what I do. At any rate, tune in next week. Monday, 10 to 12, History Today. And for now, I'll say see you then. Bye-bye now.